As you were coming in today, I printed another drawing for us to use. Eventually this morning, well, soon this morning, we'll be talking about God's instructions for the priestly garb. I hope that's said with the right level of respect, but it's a pretty grand thing that God gave very clear directions on for how the priest, particularly the high priest, was to be dressed. Last week we spent some time talking about cherubim and cherubs. Cherubs is not the plural of cherub, but cherubim is. But through our discussion that worked out pretty well. There isn't a lot said in certain respects, but we also were able to add, with the knowledge of some in the class, that Satan was, you know, a fallen angel, and he was described as a cherub. And so they also have that angelic connection. And so we saw the wings and the, in the case of Ezekiel, even those ones that were in the presence of God at his throne. And they were hard to describe, but we saw that description. And so we looked at that. The cherubim were decorative. I don't know if that's even the right word to use, but the many of the high-grade fabric coverings for the tabernacle included the cherubim. And so that's why we spent some time there. We also talked about the bronze altar made of acacia wood with bronze overlay, 7.5 foot square, 4.5 foot tall, with horns on all four corners that were one piece with the altar. God gave instructions about the utensils. They were to be made of bronze, included pails, shovels, basins, forks, fire pans, and any other utensils. Had a grate about halfway up that was bronze over acacia wood with four rings and four acacia poles with bronze overlay to carry it with. We spent some time about the court. Good morning. We spent some time with the court of the tabernacle. The court was 150 feet long, 75 feet wide, 7.5 feet high. Basically, it was a fence made of twisted linen. On the 150 foot sides, there were 20 pillars. And on the west side, where there wasn't a gate, there were 10 pillars for that 75 feet. And then the gated end was, of course, 75 feet wide, but it had 22.5 feet on each side with three pillars to hold up the covering there, and a gate that was 30 foot with four pillars. That particular fabric for the gate was to be blue, purple, and scarlet twisted linen. And of course, all of these had all of these were pillars, and they had bronze sockets, and the pillars had silver bands and hooks at the top to hold the fabric around the outside edge. We saw at the end of the chapters 27 last time, as we were looking, that all of Israel, the sons of Israel, were obligated to bring clear olive oil for the lamps, that they would be used continuously, and that Aaron's sons would keep the lamp burning from evening till morning each day. And that's pretty much what we did last time. This time, we're going to look at chapter 28. It's going to be about the priestly garments. And to begin with, I'm going to read verses 1 through 5. I better make sure. Yep, we're going. That's good. So, beginning with chapter 28 of Exodus, verse 1. Then bring near to yourself Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him, from among the sons of Israel, to minister as priest to me. Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. You shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty. You shall speak to all of the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as priest to me. These are the garments which they shall make: a breastpiece, and an ephod, and a robe, and a tunic of checkered work, a turban, and a sash. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother and his sons, that he may minister as priest to me. They shall take the gold and the blue and the purple and the scarlet material and the fine linen." So this is God's introductory discussion with Moses. Remember, he's still in that 40-day period. They're on the mountain. God is giving specific instructions of things to do that he's going to pass on when he comes down off of the mountain. And so he starts out saying to Moses, "Bring near to you Aaron and his sons." Not that he's going to do it right then, but that's going to be what he does when he gets off of the mountain. What tribe was Aaron a part of?
Levi,
as was Moses. And for before God is done, he will have the whole tribe of Levi dedicated to service in support of the priestly activities. But Aaron will have a special role, and we'll see that as we move on through that. And God says, bring them to me, Aaron and his sons, bring them close to you, and then you're going to dress them in the way I'm going to tell you, that they might minister as priests to me. And he gives their names, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And later in the scriptures, Nadab and Abihu will make themselves famous for not being very attentive to the instructions God had given about the source of fire to light the incense in the tabernacle, and God swallows them up and they go away. But that's much later on. But he names them and says, bring them here, or bring them into this service. In verse 2, he says, there will be holy garments for Aaron, and Aaron will be the high priest. And that holy word it includes apartness, a dedication, a consecration. And so his garb, his garments are intended to set him apart. And they're going to set him apart in a couple of ways. One is they're going to be pretty fantastic garments. They're going to be impressive. But they also are set apart because these are the garments that God designates for the high priest. And so when he puts these on, he's putting on the instruction of God, if you will. It's God that directed this. It's God that chose Aaron. And this, these garments show that he is there for that purpose. And God goes on to say, for both glory and beauty. And of course, in the glory, he's there to glorify God. God wouldn't be glorified by haphazardness or some sort of inappropriate clothing to serve him in that way. And so he's glorifying God by the glorification that comes from doing what God said, as well as the grandness of the garments, and they will be beautiful. And so God says, John MacArthur said that the idea here is to exalt the office and the function of the high priest. Aaron isn't just Moses' brother in this case. Aaron is functioning in the role of mediation with regard to the work of God, the sacrifices. He's there to manage all of that, to accomplish all that on behalf of the people. And these garments will have some significance with regard to their symbolism in that as well. So here's a good question. Prior to establishing the Aaronic and Levitical priesthood, so here's Aaron and his family will be the high priest, but the whole Levitical tribe will be involved with the priestly work. Who was it that mediated between God and men? Well, no. Before then. Before he establishes a high priest. Okay, so Moses did some.
The prophets.
Well, we don't have the prophets yet, really. This isn't a hard question.
Abraham is there, is the first.
So when we go back and look at history, first of all, let's go to Job 1:5. Job 1:5. Okay. My brain stopped. We'll get it. Maybe I won't. After Esther. After Esther. I was going by it for some reason. Job. There we go. Job 5:1. Is that what I said? No. Please. I was right the first time, but my brain had already twisted it. Job 1:5. And this is a...
Is it 5:1 or 1:5?
No, it's 1:5. And it's a very simple statement, but it starts to let us see how God was interacting with people and who was doing the interaction. So, Job was a good man. We know the story of Job, and he was a great man in the eyes of God and in the eyes of the people. And this is what he does at the end of the feast that's mentioned there at the beginning in verse 5 of chapter 1. When the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. And so we see throughout the Old Testament, and matter of fact, go over to Genesis 8 for a minute. We'll look at that. But you can see throughout the Old Testament, people are offering sacrifices to God. I'm going to give you a couple of examples, and then I'm going to talk in general. But in Genesis chapter 8, this is the time when Noah has been on the ark for some time. The flood subsides. He comes off the ark, and this is one of his early actions. Genesis 8, 18 through 21. So Noah went out, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by their families from the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, "I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done." And then he makes a promise about the earth remaining, that there will be seasons, there will be seed time, there will be harvest, and summer and winter and day and night, those things will never end. And so we see in this case, Noah is offering a burnt offering to God. He's there mediating on behalf of all of creation in his case, and God responds to that. And we could look at, when we studied through Genesis, we saw this, but we also saw Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What did they do everywhere they went? Build an altar and made sacrifices. That role is being refined now into this priestly function through Aaron. The people will still bring their sacrifices, but Aaron and his family will play a role in the administration of those sacrifices. And so that's part of the function of the office of priest that's being set apart and held up and is there to glorify God. In verse 3, which said to us, I'm back in Exodus 28 now. In verse 3, it says, tell the skilled persons who I have endowed with wisdom. And so he wants them to come up and be a part of this. They're to make these garments out of what God has given them. It's interesting to me that it says, tell the skilled persons that I have endowed with wisdom. If you go back and look at the Hebrew for that, the word skilled and wisdom is the same root. He's saying, tell the skilled people that I gave the skills, or tell the people with knowledge about how to do these things that I gave the knowledge to. And clearly these are men of great ability. And these men received that ability from God, and part of God's purpose, at least we know, was what they were going to be doing in the course of following the instructions that God is giving through Moses. Go to 1 Corinthians 4:6-7. First Corinthians 4, 6 and 7. So here is Paul dealing with this church in Corinth, who have all, the people have divided into groups, associated themselves, well, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Paul, I'm of Christ, and they're all trying to be somebody. They're trying to be important, they're trying to have stature, they're trying to be, well, my group's better than your group kind of a thing, and Paul has pretty well raked them over the coals for that. But look at these verses. Now these things, brethren, 1 Corinthians 4, 6 and 7. Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, so that in us you may learn not to exceed what is written, so that no one of you will become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. For who regards you as superior? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? And Paul's point here is, you know, who says you're better than another one? Obviously, they themselves said it about themselves. And he said, why do you boast? What do you have that really is yours that didn't come from above? And when we look at ourselves in life, particularly in a country where one of the common sayings was that, you know, he pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, that it's up to you what you make yourself. And certainly there are some reasonable things to say to ourselves and maybe to one another, maybe to our children as we raise them, about being industrious, about hard work pays dividends. There are some things to say about making the most of yourself. But when you get right down to it, how did David describe himself? He didn't look at all of the accomplishments. He looked back at God made him. You knit me together in my mother's womb, fearfully and wonderfully made. David recognized that what he was came from God. And you could look at that a lot of different ways. You could look at that in terms of when God created man and woman and Adam and Eve were in the garden and he said, be fruitful and multiply, he had established the biological things that would go on so that would happen. And so it was he that had built into the genes of Adam and Eve what mankind would be. And so we could look there. But you can also look that what David saw was God had planned him and his place in the world before he was ever born. And so he had built into David the opportunities, the characteristics, the attitudes, and developed him with the family he put him in, and even the jobs he was assigned under his father Jesse. Being a shepherd was a good job for David to have to develop who he needed to be as a servant of God and king of the land. And so when we look at these skilled persons, it's clear that God is saying, I'm the one that skilled them. So let's get them to do what I intended for them to do when I gave them the skills. And clearly making these garments as well as the other things that go into making the tabernacle and the court of the tabernacle, all of those things are a part of what he set up in these people. He goes on to say there in verse 3, they're to make the Aaron's garments, they're to be consecrated. Only God's chosen is to wear these. To put them on is to say you're chosen of God, and he did choose Aaron as priest. He said that Aaron would minister as priest. And that's an interesting word because if you go look at the Hebrew construction there, and I'm not a Hebrew person, so I'm just reading what I can find in the information through the concordances and the interlinears and so on. But minister as priest all comes out of one word. And it's a single word, it's kahon, and it's a verb. Make Aaron's garments so he can priest for me. It's a verb to be the priest, and it's for God, God himself following his direction. And this is the introduction of the garments, and in verse 4 he lists some. The breastpiece, the ephod, which is kind of an outer garment, a robe or a mantle, which is worn over the tunic, and that actually is going to be inside the ephod and the breastpiece. The tunic really isn't the underwear. We'll get to that a little later, but it is a long shirt-like undergarment. Sometimes it's called a coat, but in this case, it's going to be the starting point of the dress outside of some breeches. And then there's a turban that's to be there along with the sash, or a, really that often gets translated girdle, because it's in that region, the girdle region, it's a waistband. And in verse 4 he says, and these things are to be holy for Aaron and his sons. His sons will have different garb, different garments. In verse 5, he says, okay, here's the raw materials you're going to need. You're going to need gold. You're going to need blue, purple, and scarlet, and fine linen. And when you look at this, these materials are going to match some of the most impressive parts of the tabernacle and their coverings, because it's made of the same color and quality. So God is introduced to Moses. This is what you're going to do. You're going to make special garments for Aaron and for his sons. And this is the information he gave so far. Any questions or comments? Okay. So now let's take a look at verses 6 through 14. 6 through 14. They shall also make the ephod of gold, of blue, and purple, and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen, the work of the skillful workman. It shall have two shoulder pieces joined to its two ends, that it may be joined. The skillfully woven band which is on it shall be like its workmanship, one of the same material of gold, of blue, of purple, and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen. You shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on one stone and the names of the remaining six on the other stone according to their birth. As a jeweler engraves a signet, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel. You shall set them in filigree settings of gold. You shall put the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of memorial for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for a memorial. You shall make filigree settings of gold and two chains of pure gold. You shall make them of twisted cordage work, and you shall put the corded chains on the filigree settings. And so These are instructions for the ephod. And I gave you the, well, come on here. I laid out for you an artist's conception of what we're talking about. And the ephod isn't, the breastplate goes on top of it, but the ephod is this upper garment. And it talked about, we'll talk about it more in a minute, but putting pieces on the shoulder. Well, the ephod really was two pieces, one on the front, one on the back, joined then through some of the instructions we're going to see on joining them at the shoulder places. There's shoulder pieces made. But the ephod then is to be made of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet material and fine twisted linen done by the skilled workmen. So, trying to picture what this is we don't know, obviously. Nobody took a picture. But trying to make a mental image of it, clearly it's got gold in it, so probably gold thread of some sort made, along with the colors of blue, purple, and scarlet. And of course, we know all of those colors are kingly colors, particularly the purple in many cases was considered a kingly color. Now, Aaron's not a king, but he's serving one who is a king, if you will. He's serving God, who is a royalty, if you will. So it's made of those fine colors. By the way, I saw several different ones I could have picked. On the coloring, I don't like this one as well. But I liked the way it made all of the rest of the items pretty clear, so I used it. There were some pretty good images that when you start thinking about what are these colors going to look like together, did a really good job bringing out in the artist's conception the gold and the purple and the blue and the scarlet. This one, it's okay. But I think this is for what they shaped like and how they were arranged more than the grand appearance that I'm sure it had. And then in verse 7, he says, you're going to make two shoulder pieces. This is to join them together, but you're going to join the shoulder pieces at its two ends. And so you can join the ephod together. It's got a front and a back joined at the shoulders. And then it is to have a skillfully woven band or girdle. In the first portion that we read in those first five verses, it mentioned a sash. This isn't the same word, but I think they got the same meaning. Both of them, when you look at how the word was used, girdle was a part of the root for both of them, but not the same word for girdle. He wants the same workmanship as in the rest of the ephod, and this will be then the belt, if you will, the band, the girdle that will bind up this ephod around them. And so same kind of materials. In verse 9 is when he gets more specific about the two stones. They're to be made of onyx, and that's really, we don't really know what it is. Onyx doesn't have a clear, certain English counterpart for, well, what's an onyx stone? The Septuagint, when they translated the Septuagint, remember that's later, it was done for Greek-speaking people in Egypt, and the Septuagint, the original, was in the Egyptian library for some time. They translated that as emeralds, okay? Josephus was later yet, so maybe more removed from it. He said it was a sardonyx stone, which, as we understand, that's a three-layered stone. It's got black and white and red in it. Well, we really don't know. Obviously, it was going to be a stone that would be considered, very valuable, very impressive stone. On the stone are to be six names. Each stone gets six different names for the 12 tribes. And so one stone will get six, the other gets six, and they're to be done in birth order. And God even gets specific, engrave these stones with the names like a jeweler would engrave a signet. Well, what's a signet? Well, signets were, you've heard of signet ring, where they would give their sign their documents and might put some wax down and embed it in the signet ring in it to show their signal, show that. Some cultures, actually, their signets were cylinders, and they would keep them on their belt almost. So they weren't on a ring, but they would get them off of their belt. They had a container for it there, and I don't know if they rolled it in it or what they did, but that was the signet. So these were prized things. If you had a signet ring, it was something. And so it would have been well made. And then the names are to be in filigree settings of gold. Okay, so I'm not a jeweler and I don't know much about jewelry. And So I'm sitting going, what is this? Well, the filigree, some of you here probably could describe it better than I can, but they would typically use gold wire and make a shape or a design and then solder it or attach it to itself. And so these stones would have a gold wire type structure that was in jewelry form around them to go onto these shoulder pieces. Who would add something to that at this point? Okay, so the two stones were to go on the shoulder pieces as a memorial to the sons of Israel, that Aaron would bear the names before God. And what God is doing is establishing that this kingdom, this priesthood, the whole worshipful activities that center around the tabernacle and the court are based on, came out of God's promises to Abraham to make a great nation. And so as Aaron is doing this, he's there representing these people, obedient before God in the way God has to be worshipped by these people. And so Aaron is doing that. And this is a memorial. This is to keep the memory going. This is to keep reminding Aaron, and he's doing it before God, almost like he's saying, yes, God, I'm here once again, representing the 12 tribes. I'm here doing that. And so this is to keep it on people's minds. It's also to keep it on the minds of the people as Aaron is doing these things. They know their tribe's name is written on one of those stones because Aaron right now, when he's making that sacrifice, he's making on behalf of us and our tribe standing within the household of Abraham and being children of the promise. In verse 13, he once again says, make these with filigree settings of gold. So that's important to God. He mentions it several times. I imagine these were ornate in ways that we can't begin to put our imaginations to and really see it. And then in verse 14, he says, oh, by the way, make two chains of pearl gold, pure gold, twisted in cordage. Corded chains then go on the settings that he made. And this I actually feel like I have a little bit of an imagination for, because some fair number of years ago now, well, it's a long story, so I don't want to tell it, but my wife, her wedding ring, we were replacing it and using some jewelry that came from her grandfather and so on and so on. But in the course of doing that, the original wedding ring, we had the stone put on a pendant, and they were showing us the various gold chains that could hold the pendant. And some of those were, I mean, I think they fit just what it said here. They had made out of gold thread-like material, and then they had twisted it, and so it was a cord-like material with a spiral in it. Was that this? I don't know, but that's what I imagine, because that's what I have seen when I look at it. And so these corded chains of gold were there to be on the settings, to be part of the attachment to make these shoulder pieces hold the ephod front and back together. Questions, comments, thoughts? A lot of details. And so we'll keep on going through those. Let's look at verses 15 to 30. Verses 15 to 30. You shall make a breastpiece of judgment, the work of a skillful workman, like the work of the ephod. You shall make it of gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen you shall make it. It shall be square and folded double, a span in length and a span in width. You shall mount on it four rows of stones. First row shall be a row of ruby, topaz, and emerald. The second row, turquoise, sapphire, and diamond. And the third row, a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst. and the fourth row a beryl and an onyx and a jasper. They shall be set in gold filigree. The stone shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to the names. They shall be like the engravings of a seal, each according to his name for the 12 tribes. You shall make on the breastpiece chains of twisted cordage work in pure gold. You shall make the breastpiece two rings of gold and shall put the two rings on the two ends of the breastpiece. You shall put the two cords of gold on the two rings at the ends of the breastpiece. You shall put the other two ends of the two cords of the two filigrees on the two filigree settings and put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod at the front of it. You shall make two rings of gold and shall place them on two ends of the breastpiece on the edge of it, which is toward the inner side of the ephod. You shall make two rings of gold and put them on the bottom of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod, on the front of it, close to the place where it is joined above the skillfully woven band of the ephod. They shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a blue cord, so that it will be on the skillfully woven band of the ephod, and that the breastpiece will not come loose from the ephod. Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place for the memorial before the Lord continually. You shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord, and Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. All right, so God just gave some more details. You got that all in your head? Well, I tried to put it in mine, and I'll give you my best efforts to understand how this garment all came together. And it's not all my information. I pulled from a few other places too, but these words nobody can say, oh, it was just like this and just like that. But there's a breast piece that's going to be made. It's called the breast piece of judgment. Now, not everybody's version is going to say judgment. Some of yours say decisions. No? I thought I saw that in some of the other versions. The word here for judgment could have easily been decisions. Now, it's going to be made by skilled people, just like the ephod. It's going to have gold, purple, and scarlet, and fine linen in its construction. It's going to be a square folded over double. And we could start an argument, but I'm pretty sure that they've got it right in the drawing here. Some folks say, well, it starts out square, and then you fold it, so then it's not really square anymore after it's folded. No, I don't think that's right. It's square, but there's two squares, one in front, one in back. It's folded over. And it's a span in length and width. A span is about a half a cubit, which is about 9 inches. Another way that they would measure it is the distance between your thumb and your little finger end, the end of your thumb. But it's about 9 inches is what it came out to be for most people. And so that's what it is. It's about 9 inches square. And on it, there are four rows of stones. And you heard me say them. The first row was ruby, topaz, emerald. Second was turquoise, sapphire, and diamond. The third, that can't be right. I think I wrote it down wrong. I think it's jacinth. In verse 19, jacinth. Yeah, I wrote it down wrong here. An agate and an amethyst. And then in verse 4, beryl, onyx, and jasper. Now, all of these stones are to be set in gold filigree. So you've got this patterned wire gold setting that these stones all go in. And the stones represent the names of the 12 tribes. And it's to be like the engravings of a seal. Now, there's never, as far as I can see, any instructions to engrave anything on these stones. So I'm guessing that the four rows represent a birth order, and they would know based on which tribe they were, which stone went with them. But they're to be ornate. They're to be significant in their appearance. That's like the engravings of a seal. When the king would seal something, that would be done with an ornate or a very clear high quality type of an appearance. And then he says, there are to be chains of twisted cordage made of pure gold. And there's going to be two rings of gold at the end of the breast piece. And the cord is then to go on the rings. One end of the cord will go on the filigree settings on the shoulder pieces of gold. And then two more gold rings at the end of the breast piece on the edge toward the inner side of the ephod. And so you're going to have these rings of gold. In verse 27, you get two on the bottom shoulder of the shoulders, on the shoulder pieces of the ephod, close to where they join above the band of the skillfully woven band on there. And so they're binding this breast piece onto the priest by attaching it to the ephod. And they use blue cord to attach it. And it's to be skillfully, it will be on the skillfully woven band and will not come loose. So it's to be a firm attachment. This is to be well connected to the ephod. And in verse 29, he says, then Aaron will carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place. And it's to be a memorial before the Lord continually. And in the breastpiece of decision, we're going to put the Urim and the Thummim over the heart when he goes before the Lord. So there are two things that this breastpiece connects to Aaron that will be before God every time he's in the presence of God wearing these garments. One are the 12 stones representing the 12 tribes. We already have the memorial stones on the shoulder pieces, but then we also have these 12 stones. We have the two stones with the names engraved on the shoulder pieces, and then we have these 12 stones on the front of the breast piece. But in the breast piece, in this fold over, in some fashion it makes a pocket or similar, he's to have the Urim and the Thummim, and they're both of these sets of stones, and the Urim and Thummim are to be over his heart, and he's to carry it continually when he's before the Lord. Does anybody know what the Urim and the Thummim is? Thummim, not Thummim, Thummim. Well, you put yourself in good company, because the best of scholars can't tell you really what these were. In some fashion, these are used in determining direction from God. Some would say in a very thinly connected way, they'd be a little bit like rolling dice. Somehow you've got these two items and they would be used, tumble them on the table and see how they come up or something like that. Might be one way that they are used to find out the directions that God wants to give and the answers to their inquiries to God. But there's just nothing historically found, nothing mentioned in the Bible about how they're to be used. So we really don't know a lot about them. But they were clearly a part of what God wanted the high priest, starting with Aaron, to have on his person, contained in this breast piece, as a part of the clothing that qualified him, that was a part of his stature to be the high priest before God. And maybe they weren't physically used at all. Maybe it had some other role, but we just don't know what it was.
Matthew Henry mentions, he's like, they already have these. So he says, you know, include the Umim and the Thummim or whatever.
Yep.
And he's like, so the clear indication is that these would have been objects that they had already had access to somehow. And so his interpretation is either those objects were given by God on the mountain, or they were previously used and then included in the priestly garments, which
yep.
is astute, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, clearly God expected Moses to know what he was talking about. So, yeah, it was something they were familiar with, but we've lost that familiarity. Any Questions so far?
You said something about the stones on the breastplate not being engraved, and my version says they were engraved.
Well, maybe I misunderstood that. Let's go look at that. That would be
12 stones with their names according to the names of Israel. It is like signets, each engraved with its names.
Oh, okay. Well, let me find that again. Starting with 24 about.
21
is 21 where it says it?
They would have been engraved on the shoulder and on the breastplate.
Well, and this might be one where I should have gone beyond the American Standard a bit. American Standard says they shall be like the engravings of a seal, each according to its name. So I won't say they weren't engraved. When I read what I read here, I saw that as something different than being actually engraved, but I don't have any reason to say they weren't, so that's a good correction. I wouldn't argue with that a bit. Anyone else? Well, let me look real quick at where I'm at. Yeah. I think I'd like to stop here and just visit for a minute and kind of a conclusion about where this is all going. We're going to get to the robe and the other parts that go along with supporting this, and we'll do that next time. But the thing that struck me as I'm going through this, I'm looking at this saying, so what's the significance of all this? And there are a couple of things that stand out very quickly. And one thing that stands out very quickly is God is giving very, very explicit instructions. And so these things were important to God to be in this way. And so my question is, why? Well, when he gives us significance, he actually tells us of the significance in several ways. If you looked back at verse 2 of chapter 28, it says, "You shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty." So God is doing this. When you say holy, that's set apart. That's in the realm of God. That's a being separate from the rest of sinful humanity. Now, don't get me wrong. Aaron wasn't exactly free from sin, was he? But when he puts this garb on, I maybe shouldn't say garb, when he puts these garments on, and when he's doing things under the instruction of God in the way God wants, he is carrying out the work of God. He is set apart. He is acting in a holy fashion in accordance with the instructions of God to take care of the sins of the people and all of the things that go along with the relationship that God is establishing with the people and this form of worship that he's establishing and how they are going to worship him, interact with him, bring sacrifices to him, receive instruction from him, and carry out his intended deeds. But also, it's to be for glory and for beauty. And so God is here through the way that he is dressing the high priest, showing the people his own glory. And he wants it to be descriptive of him, glorifying of him, as well as of extremely impressive beauty to show that this is what God deserves. This is what's expected to be associated with God himself and what God would establish as what worship of him should look like, is to set Aaron apart in this way of extreme beauty and the holiness and the glorification of God. So that's one, or one set. Questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah, Dave?
Yeah, the Latin translation for the word priest is pontifex.
Okay.
Which means bridge builder.
Yeah.
And so a priest is not the bridge. He is a bridge builder. And thing about Pontifex, bridge builder, we often hear the Pope referred to as the Pontiff.
Yes.
Which would be the chief remaining bridge builder. But the interesting thing is, and I think it would be a good reason why we should really pay very close attention to the importance and function of the priest, is Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 2, both verses 5 and 9. It's really interesting. He's got a lot of Old Testament allusion. He says in verse 5, you also have living stones.
Mm-hmm.
So we have stones here on the priestly garment where the 12 tribes, the people of God's name is written. Today in the new covenant, we are living stones, people of God. He said we are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood. So every individual member of the body of Christ is a priest and mm-hmm. part of the priesthood of God to be offering up spiritual sacrifices. So we are to function as priests because we are. And in verse 9, he says, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Just sitting in this room right now are probably 30-some individuals who are members of the royal priesthood of God. To be bridge builders, to be a man of God, to be offering up spiritual sacrifices, exactly as these priests were. So I think as we study the role of priests, it's very applicable. I mean, it's totally applicable to us today.
Yes, it is. And God builds off of this in a number of ways, because while we are a royal priesthood, we also have Jesus as our new high priest. And when Jesus is functioning as our high priest, the attributes that God places on him, you could look particularly in the book of Hebrews. I wasn't planning on going quite there, but in the book of Hebrews 9, 10, 11, somewhere in there, 11's too late, 8, 9, 10, when Jesus is described as a high priest, there are many things that are said about him that eclipse the Aaronic priesthood, including he didn't get it by lineage. He's not a Levite. He didn't get it by lineage. He got it because of his holiness, his sinlessness, and God's choosing of him separate from being a part of this priesthood. And it goes on to talk about he suffered through, I don't want to say suffered, but he was tempted in every way just as we are, yet without sin. And so he can look at us with empathy toward what it's like for us to live in this world of sin. He lived here. He was tempted specifically by Satan. And many more than just the three that are written down, I know. And he didn't sin, and so he's got that. Plus, the sacrifices he brings eclipse anything here, because the sacrifice he brings is his own blood. Once for all. Doesn't have to be done over and over and over. And there are many other things said. And so the picture we get here, and throughout a study of what was a priest like, begins to lay the foundation for understanding the role of Christ sitting at the right hand of God as our advocate, dealing with our problems with sin and bringing sanctification to us, bringing to us what the earthly priest never could do with the earthly sacrifices of a clear conscience. And there's just so much more to be said about that. But so thanks for bringing that role in, that in, Dave, about the role of the priest. And we need to take it seriously, just what Dave said, as our roles as part of that priesthood. God said you will be a nation of priests earlier in our study of Exodus, if you remember that. And yet by the time we get here, we're seeing establishment of a specific priesthood to carry out the priestly functions for the nation. And God's intention was that they would be his testifiers to the world to invite people into his kingdom. Didn't work. They weren't faithful to those commitments. But we need to be. So, the other thing that I wanted to point out is, as we worked our way through these, that is much more at the mundane level than the big picture and where we're at spiritually as priests of God today. But God goes into a lot of detail here. And I think as we recognize that, this is not haphazard on God's part. God goes into that detail. These things have meaning to God, and we're getting some of the meaning very clearly when these items are listed as a memorial. He's wanting to remind the people constantly, as well as the high priest himself, just what he's doing. He's there bringing the sacrifices of the people and carrying those out on their behalf in front of God, and these things are to be a clear part of the memorial of that, plus all of the other details. Sometimes we get the idea that there are big things and little things. But God was very clear, he who is unfaithful in little is unfaithful in much. And as we live as, using the scriptures Dave brought in, as we live as priests on God's behalf, you know, I'm appalled when I look at myself and the little things. There aren't any little things, but the things that I have considered little and not executed in the way that God would have had me perfectly, it damages my priesthood. It damages the testimony. I mean, you can just keep going with that. And God was very specific about these details, and I think we need to pay close attention to the details. And how will we do that if we don't know the Word of God? It's just that simple. What else?
I was thinking about how you were talking about no mundane or sacred. There's no difference between sacred and secular. And I think oftentimes in looking at a passage like this, it's easy to gloss over and say, oh, these are just measurements for a religion that has been and isn't looking forward. And I think that sometimes we get into that habit and of not seeing some of these things, in particular, like the aesthetics of the priestly garments and the aesthetics of the tabernacle. In our very modern society and instant gratification culture, even in our architecture and things like this, we have the tendency to overlook some of these things when God is very specific about using materials that are that help lift the human mind towards the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, although we have a lot of disagreements with the Roman Catholic Church, this is one place where the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches do a really good thing. You know, I just attended a funeral for my aunt, a Catholic mass funeral, and I was just looking at the architecture, and I'm just like, I can understand why these things are mm-hmm. the way that they are. And I think that in a lot of our evangelical societies, we've kind of discarded some of these things for the purpose of, you know, saying that this is mundane, it's not sacred, when in reality, our buildings are sacred, our work with our hands is sacred. And I think that that's what we see here, is that God has ordained these skills to be given to these people in order to exercise them to lift our eyes towards heaven.
Yeah, I would not disagree with that at all. At the same time, there are so many things that we start with a good place and wind up in a bad place. And I would say that over time, I mean, and here's where my mind goes to instantly. Well, why did Herod build a temple? Was he really trying to direct people to God? No, I don't think so. And yet he built a grand temple because it was going to help him politically. He was going to make a lot of Jews really satisfied with what he provided so they could continue in their worship. And maybe I'm being too hard on Herod, but you know, we can build things intended to glorify God, and the next guy that builds it might be building it so he can show he can build one better than mine. So when it's done for God and to glorify God, I entirely agree. And I think many of the structures that are old were done with that intent. And maybe new ones. I'm not trying to say anything by that, but it's, yeah. Is it a monument to God or a monument to man? And so, yeah, I do think that has some value. We could have a fun conversation about that. We're out of time. So anything else? All right, well, we'll pick it up next week. Lots of details.